Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our June 1st meeting of the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. We're glad to see all of you, and I hope that you've had a chance to notice that in meeting materials we have posted a draft of Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3400, which include a lot of good work and thinking that's been done by a bunch of different people in the community, and we're going to have an informational hearing on that that I'll open shortly. First, I'm going to give you an overview of what we're going to do this evening. We're going to invite Mark Mayer, Legislative Counsel, who's done some of these revisions up, and you can hang on for just a minute if you want, Mark. He's going to briefly go through and identify the major policy changes that are manifest in the Dash 8 amendments for folks who haven't yet had a chance to read it, which is probably everyone in this room, except for maybe one or two people, because it's newly posted. And then we'll invite OLCC to come forward and give their insights on some great stakeholder work that they have been doing with a lot of the folks in the room, and talk about some of their strong feelings or some of the great progress that's been made, I think, in getting folks aligned. And then we will open it up to public comment. We may not even end up taking all the way till 7 o'clock, but that's our game plan for tonight. And as we further refine the draft, we'll have additional opportunities for hearing and work session. So if you haven't identified all your issues with this draft yet, don't worry, you've got some more time, but we want to flag for you what's happening. And with that, I will open the informational hearing on the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3400 and invite Mark Mayer to come forward and describe for us the major policy changes that have been incorporated into this amendment. Welcome.
Chairs Burdick, Leininger, members of the Measure 91 Committee. My name is Mark Mayer, Legislative Counsel, and I think that there are probably 11 policy points that I should draw your attention to, or the attendees' attention to. And what I'll do is I'll walk through the bill in order so that people build a hopefully follow along. I'll specify the page, and then I'll talk about the policy change that occurred there. There was a lot of changes to some of the language, to some of how the original language with regard to the technical fixes was handled and things like that. I'm not going to cover that material. I just want to highlight things that I've noticed have been contentious or somewhat a point of interest throughout the committee hearings. So I think the first flag is on page 17, section 12. And this would apply to all license holders, but I'll just take a look. I'll just show you where it's at with regard to the first license holder. In the original draft, we said every individual listed on an application had to be a resident of the state for 2 or more years. That language has now changed to an applicant listed on an application must be a resident of this state for one or more years. So we've reduced the residency requirement by a year. And by changing the language from individual to applicant, we have effectively limited to the persons who are going to actually be running the operations. Persons with a financial interest in an operation would not be held to the residency requirement with this language change. Page 19, section 13. If you remember correctly, this section was originally the canopy size section, and there was an indication that we were going to write into the canopy size section specific canopy sizes for certain terms of licensure. This draft contemplates the fact that that would be handled in rule. And the current section of law here directs OLCC to do three things. The first thing is to make sure that the production levels of indoor and outdoor grows are equivalent. So they might have different canopy sizes with regard to indoor and outdoor grow sizes, just as long as the production level is equivalent. The second thing is a tiered system whereby good actors are rewarded upon renewal of a license, and they can have a larger canopy size. And then finally, directing the OLCC to take into consideration market demand for marijuana items in this state and the number of persons applying for a license or who hold a license, and whether the availability of marijuana items in this state is commensurate with that demand. So they're supposed to take a look at three things in adopting rules. Page 34, we did some work with the licensing and enforcement specialist language with regard to marijuana licensing enforcement specialists. I just wanted to point out two things that the commission asked for with regard to this language, which are toward the bottom of page 34 in subsection 2. One is, commission licensing enforcement specialist may not be sworn in as a federal law enforcement official and act in that capacity while performing the duties under this section. So it's directing dual co-sworn individuals who are both sworn in and federally and at the state level to only function at the state level when they're performing their duties under this section. And then the second thing that it directs them to not do is carry a firearm. This is actually not a policy point. Page 37, section 35, my understanding is we're still waiting on some language with regard to land use. But I just wanted to flag that for the committee because that has not been completely updated here. So the next major policy changes in this draft, there were some technical fixes to the tax piece, and we're incorporating those into the final draft of this, but really that tax piece, policy-wise, remains largely the same. If you flip all the way to page 75, testing, a lot of the language from the original draft has been maintained. What has changed here is that the commission is now going to do the licensing of the testing laboratories, while OLCC will still be in charge of accreditation and largely will be in charge of rulemaking. So there is OLCC underneath this version is going to be in charge of licensing the testing laboratories and providing enforcement, whereas OHA will be in charge of accrediting and for the most part, rulemaking as to what should be tested. So there's a bit of a split here. A lot of the language is retained from the other draft. It is mainly splitting out those functions. Page 82, packaging, labeling, and dosage. Again, a lot of the language from the original dash ones has been retained. I want to ensure everybody that, you know, the commission did look at that language and try to honor it. What has happened here is, again, a little bit of a split in the enforcement powers and in the rule adoption powers. The labeling of the products is going to stay with Oregon Health Authority underneath this version. They will still be adopting the rules for those. In addition to that, the Oregon Health Authority will be adopting dosage standards, which was not in the original draft. Packaging standards will be adopted by the commission, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, by rule. So those are the differences in this particular draft from the last one. On page 89, and this is where we start to get into some of the stuff that hasn't been changed, but people haven't seen before. So I'll probably take just a little bit more time on these.
Can you give us a point of reference again?
Page 89. This is the research certificate, and the idea of the research certificate was in the Dash 1 amendments, but it hadn't been fully fleshed out yet. Here we've attempted to do that. There was a desire to call this a research license, and I try to honor that, but what I did is I went through and I looked at all the provisions of Measure 91 that apply to licensees, And there are certain provisions that would create a problem for research licensees. So I did retain certificate, hopefully some language that I talked about with Mr. Jesse Sweet over at the Liquor Control Commission will work here. On page 90, subsection 6, except as exempted by the commission by rule, rules adopted by the commission for the purpose of administering and enforcing sections 3 to 70, measure 91, with respect to license and licensee representatives, apply to persons certified under this section and persons employed by or who otherwise perform work for persons certified under this section. So the rules adopted by the commission with regard to licensees, they're going to apply to these certificate holders, except that the commission can exempt them out from those rules. And I think that that'll help create some consistency in how they are treated. The issue with calling them a licensee, again, it's a statutory problem with how licensee and licensee represented is used throughout all of the provisions of 91, and some of them just probably don't work with research, with the idea of licensing a researcher. On page 91, this is brand new language, edibles. And what we have done is, the request was to make edibles subject to normal food processes. If you look at line 20, subsection 2 of section 112, in exercising its authority under ORS Chapter 616, the department may not establish standards for marijuana as a food additive, consider marijuana to be an adulterant, unless certain aspects of the extract exceed acceptable levels that are determined by the commission, or apply certain statutes that just shouldn't apply in the situation to them, such as measurements and weights and things like that, and I could go into more detail over those if necessary. So, in other words, we're going to treat them like a food item. Kitchen standards, things like that, they'll be handled like other food items, with the exception of a few statutes. I think one of the most, one of the greatest things of interest is on page 92. It's the marijuana grow site opt-in for medical marijuana grows. And this language is intended to allow marijuana grow sites to choose, not to be required to, but to choose to participate in the Measure 91 system. And my understanding is the way it would work is they would be able to sell their products then into both systems, subject to rules adopted by the authority and the commission with regard to where that product is going. I did want to point out real quickly that we have some standard language that they're going to be subject to the provisions of Measure 91 on page 93. We have also included language in subsection 3 on line 11 that the commission may waive by rule or order the application of any provision of Measure 91 or rule adopted under Measure 91 to a person responsible for a grow site. So the commission can waive those provisions or rules that just are somewhat inapplicable. If you turn the page to page 94, energy and water usage, this is sections 115 and 116. Section 115 is merely a reporting mechanism where producers under Measure 91 have to report certain information related to where their water is coming from and their water usage. Section 116... which is the energy usage statute, basically it requires marijuana producers who utilize artificial grow lights, so indoor grows, to come up with an energy plan and submit it to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which will work in conjunction with the State Department of Energy to ensure energy-efficient operations. The State Department of Energy, will come up with a baseline of energy efficient use underneath this draft, considering best industry practices. So what should the kilowatt hour per square feet of grow canopy be? What should the energy use of producers be? They'll come up with that baseline, and then part of the plan requires the growers to basically submit a plan for how are we going to meet that baseline? How are we going to come under it? And then along with that, a fee will have to be paid if they are unable to meet certain energy goals as prescribed on pages 96 and 97. So if you're of a certain size, grow canopy size, you'll have a certain energy goal. A larger canopy size is going to have a more restrictive energy goal. And that is pretty much the large scale changes. We did do a general reduction in crime for the crimes section. So I encourage people to look at that as well throughout those sections.
Okay. Does it? Yes, Senator Prezonsky.
What's the co-chair's desire on how to go over any of these that we just skimmed over? Do you want us to raise the flag them now, or how do you want to do it?
I would like to propose that we hear from OLCC folks, because I think that they're going to, my understanding is that they're going to be able to speak to some of the thinking that went into the requests they made, many of which are reflected in this draft. And then we could walk through it. Does that sound good? Okay.
Co-chairs Leininger and Burdick, may I say one more thing for the record? What we have before us also is a draft copy, which our office doesn't release very often. So there might be some technical things. There are also some things that were requested, very minor things, that just couldn't make it into this draft for on timeliness purposes. But just everybody's aware that this is pretty much reflective of what people's desires were, but there were a few technical things and stuff like that that didn't get handled here. And there might be some cross references and that are inaccurate, and some other wording issues. I'm without an editor on this one, so.
So, if I may, to be clear, and Mr. Mayor is not saying this, he got a huge amount of input from a lot of the people in this room and outside of this room by the close of business Friday evening, and while the rest of us were enjoying spectacularly good weather, I'm pretty sure that you spent a lot of the weekend drafting, and without an editor, getting this to be in such good form that by midday today we were able to post it under meeting materials, not as an official amendment, but you did spectacular work. I mean, it was a heroic effort, so thanks.
To consider it a reflection of me and not our office. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So,
too busy to shave.
So if we could have folks from the OLCC, whomever you'd like to have come forward right now, that'd be great. And Mr. Mayor, if you are still awake, we would love to have you stick around after these guys so that you can answer questions if people have them. Is that all right? Thanks so much. Welcome. These folks have been working tremendously hard also putting together the infrastructure that will enable us to do effective rulemaking, but also helping us get input on the front end so that this bill, that this House Bill 3400 can be as good and reflect as much community consensus as possible. So welcome. Please state your name for the record. If Mr. Patridge, you're kicking it off, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you. Co-chairs, for the record, I'm Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and joining me today is Steve Marks, the executive director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We obviously got this draft this afternoon. We certainly appreciate the hard work that Mark Mayer and Shannon O'Fallon have put in related to trying to bring a product to you. We think the product, at least on our initial review, is pretty close to what the ad hoc group has put together. We've got some stuff, obviously, and as Mark said, he didn't have an editor available either, though I know he was emailing people off and on frantically throughout the weekend trying to figure out what was going on, and I think I saw some piece of mail from him from about 10 o'clock last night that went out. So we certainly think that this encompasses most of the changes that we had suggested. We have a strong commitment by the group that we've continued to work with to go over this entire draft tomorrow and work all day for as long as it takes to get out a consensus product, we hope, that then we can bring to the co-chairs and Mark for drafting for a presentation to the committee, as long as the co-chairs are amenable to the amendments that go into the draft. Obviously that there are some things that end up missing or some nits and final word choices that we need to do, but we think that for the majority of this, it's been incorporated in our review over the last 3 hours. We don't think that there's anything glaringly that we, at least at this initial review, that we have noticed that are missing. Certainly I think that the early start provisions that now we've seen also in the Dash 3 amendments versus the amendment that is in Section 129 that Mr. Mayor pointed out are certainly, a topic for discussion here today. That was not something that we had certainly contemplated as the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Beyond that, I can comment on any of the pieces in the measure, but I'm not sure we have anything specifically for testimony for you tonight related to the Dash 8 amendments right now. I think we would be remiss to say much about the Dash 8 amendments at this point in time until we talk to the ad hoc group and come to you with some of those recommendations.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. On the opt-in, the medical grow opt-in, which came out of your meetings with the stakeholders, on page 93 on that section, subsection 3 that Mr. Mayor pointed out, it talks about waiving by rule the application of any provision of the regulatory thing. Is that aimed at the medical growers who participate? For example, some that where a security system may not be practical. What is the intent of this?
I think our intent is to waive pieces of the rules so we can bring them in as they currently sit in place. Really, it's our intent to bring people, into a system for those who want to opt in to a track system at a lower cost to prevent black market leakage and to do all the things that they want to do and allow them the opportunity to not only be the supplier on the medical side, but also to allow them the opportunity to take any excess product and put it into the retail market. I think we haven't really spent much time looking at this language piece. There may be some issues related to, just on first blush, related to whether the OLCC has the right to waive a statute versus its own rules. So there's some legal issues that we need to take a look at related to this, and that would be one of the items that we need to spend some time on. And we've already got Shannon O'Fallon from DOJ looking at this draft as well.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up, but this provision is aimed at the medical people. This isn't aimed at the people who go strictly recreational. Is that correct, or is it available to both? In other words, if somebody wants to be strictly a recreational grower, would they be able to avail themselves of this as well, or just the medical people?
My understanding was that we just wanted the medical people so we could bring them in place. If it was, and I haven't spent a lot of time with the nuance, the intent was that you could bring the medical people in place. And if it's overbroad, then we'll certainly look at narrowing that tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Grzanski.
Just following up with what Co-Chair Burek said, my understanding, we had that schematic, and it showed those who are coming in just for recreational have their own path. This was the one that was going horizontal that are existing as medical, or if they come in, they want to start off as medical, they would still have that opportunity, but they'll be limited to whatever we have as those caps and and number of plants or mm-hmm. if it's canopy or whatever. That's
right. That was correct? Our intent. That is correct.
And go ahead, please.
So the only thing I heard as to the overview by Mark that caught my ear was page 17, section 12, changing to 1 year residency versus the 2 year residency that we'd moved from 4 years. Can you give us a little insight of how that came about?
We had not, the consensus group had not really talk to any great degree about a residency requirement and a consensus related to a residency requirement. So I don't know particularly how this got in there. Is that, I believe that's correct.
Madam Chair, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director. There was a discussion about that and whether it was 1 or 2 years and the limitation to the one single person of that standard for residency. I would just say this, that the consensus group is working on that. The OLCC is not weighing in on residency per se ourselves in terms of where it's required or number of years. So I wanted to make that clear. We were sort of the neutral party helping them to get an arrangement that worked on that.
I sat in on some of those conversations, and I agree that it didn't sound to me like you were driving an outcome. But I would say that I heard a lot of people in the room say that they wanted to make it very clear that people with a financial interest would go through background checks, thorough background checks, but not be subject to investors would not be subject to a residency requirement. And I personally think that that makes a fair amount of sense. And I also heard from the same group that they thought a one-year residency requirement was more appropriate than a two-year, and they liked the idea that a person in charge be subject to it, but that it not be every single person who's written down on a piece of paper, some of whom have really wild different roles. So it's it's down on this document so that we can talk about it and get feedback on it, but you know, if you have strong feelings, it will be good to hear that. And if people in the community have strong feelings, it will be good to hear that.
Madam Chair, if I can just follow up. Based on what I'd heard and I talked to Commissioner Petridge, I think many of us are in agreement that to, let's say, clear the decks for people who want to come in from outside to invest, so long as there's enough criteria to confirm through a background check that we're not dealing with some type of enterprise that we don't want to be, that would be in jeopardy with the Cole memo. But clearly, at the same time, we were, at least from my perspective, I had not heard anyone wanting to drop their residency from 2 after we dropped it from 4 to 1. So I'm wondering if this was maybe an oversight that that somehow this got in there. So I'll bring that up at more appropriate time, because we've already kind of looked at this of wanting to maintain some continuity and ensuring that we don't have people coming into the process at these different license holders, that at least in the beginning, to ensure that we have control for the federal issues that are raised in the Cole memo. So,
Madam Chair,
any other thoughts? Yes.
I was not part of this discussion, but I was actually pleased to see this in the draft, and a little surprised, but pleased to see it, because as I've been thinking it over and talking to people, the need for capital is so high as we move for some of these areas to comply. And the thought is that if we are careful about limiting the size of grows and careful with the background check requirement, that we may be able to accomplish much or all of what we were hoping to get through a residency requirement, and that is to give the Oregon industry a leg up to the extent we can legally as this process gets underway. And by limiting the size of the canopies or the plants or however we do it, that in effect might serve the same purpose while allowing more capital to come in.
Madam Chair, maybe I wasn't clear. I have no problem with people bringing capital in, not having the residency requirement as a holder of the license who's running the place, because to me it's very essential that those who are actually running the businesses in the state of Oregon, that we have greater control than the people that are infusing money into Oregon businesses. So I think we're talking the same thing as it pertains to people bringing money into these ventures. It's who's on the ground, who's accountable within the state for the operation of the business itself as to the residency part.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the subject of canopy sizes, page 19,
There's a shift here that there be canopy size regulations for both outdoor and indoor. In the last version, we were talking doing plants, number of plants for outdoor. I'm not sure how that conversation went, or OLCC had that part of the conversation, or someone else did. This is wondering if there's some illumination on that.
Co-chairs and Representative Buckley, that was a consensus from the group that that it could be put in rule at OLCC and then it be based on canopy size that was equitable. Nobody's seen this full set of language yet, but I think that was clearly the consensus of the group to go to a canopy size as long as the overall harvest limits, taking into account the harvest types, was done in an equitable manner.
Very good. And if I can follow?
Yes.
It's also a shift, too, and I guess it's worthy consideration that the commission would set the sizes of the canopy size limitations as we start off. I do have some concern, though. I appreciate the criteria that's in the bill and how to do that. And I don't know, at some point, I'd love if Seth Crawford from OSU is here to get his thoughts on what levels that might be, at least in terms of, as someone who's studied the field very much. I just have a concern that if we set it, there are impacts of the different size that we set it. The larger we start off with, I think at least the more concern I would have that we're inviting in an industry that would not be homegrown. It would be more financed and focused on larger entities. So I just want to express that concern.
I think that's a great point. And my hope is that we'll have Mr. Crawford and others come forward after we finish this conversation and perhaps have a chance to walk through the bill with Mr. Mayer's input. So, but yes, let's definitely make sure you come in and talk about that. Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. I wanted to get your comments a bit on page 94, section 115, 116 on the energy and water use. As I look at that, and especially considering the role of the State Department of Energy in this, I'm kind of wondering where this all came from, and I guess maybe I could answer part of the question. I remember one of the presentations we had at the outset, where we saw how much electricity can be used with an indoor grow. And I was impressed with the amount of electricity that was required here. But I'm wondering about these sections here with the Department of Energy determining by rule the amount of electricity that should be used here. I wonder what their experience is in coming up with such a calculation, if that's anything that can really be counted on to have any veracity. And I'm also wondering of a word used on page 95, down at the bottom here. A marijuana producer that utilizes artificial grow lights to produce marijuana is subject to the fee described in subsection 6. It looks to me like they would be assessed a fine, for what the Department of Energy would consider excess electricity usage. Does this have any basis in... really have any basis at all in past history of this whole business?
Co-chairs and Representative Wilson, this was not a consensus. I'm not sure how this particular piece of legislation got in there, and you have somebody immediately to your right. I do believe it came. We did hear it when we were out on the road. So I'll the good representative to Buckley could probably elaborate on that further.
I'll say, I'm sensitive to water use, obviously, but right, not so much toward electricity use, because I, at least for me, with a couple of radio stations and a bunch of transmitters, I'm pretty sensitive about my electricity use. And if somebody came in to determine how much electricity I should be using, I would be pretty resentful of that, I would think.
I know that this was a concern from co-ops and others, so yes. I'll let Representative Buckley, because sure, it looks
let's
like his language. So.
Let's have Representative Buckley speak to
a brief
these
explanation.
Thank you,
ma'am. Thank you, Representative. My city of Ashland actually to focus on this, the way the utility system works, that if there is a consumption of energy within a utility at a certain level, rates for all utility users will go up. So I'm trying to protect your bill, sir, with your radio stations, and make sure that your bill does not go up through the abundant use of energy through grow lights, which, as the presentation showed, can use a tremendous amount of energy. The city of Arcata, California, experienced this when their medical marijuana laws changed and basically pushed more people inside to grow. The consumption in the city of Arcata was so much that the voters finally passed an ordinance to require additional charges for overuse, what was perceived as extraordinary use of energy. In addition, in Colorado, much of this, the ideas behind what's in the amendment come from the experience of Colorado, which does indoor grows. And Colorado is already moving in this direction to try to make sure that as indoor grows continue to expand, that energy use does not expand to the detriment of other utility users.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Did you have a follow-up?
No, I'm thinking.
Okay. Coach, I don't know if you want the – we've got the people here who have been part
of
the
– Yes, thank you.
We'd like to bring forward in case there's any questions for the panel.
Thank you.
Jonathan Aaron, Anthony Taylor, and Jeff Sugarman will speak. And as you know, they want to talk about the consensus process and – they will want to speak to all other matters in the bill at some appropriate point, but just on our process going
Thank
forward.
Thank you. So to clarify for folks who are watching, the work that's been happening in the last couple of weeks that OLCC has had a really active role in convening has involved stakeholders from a bunch of different perspectives, and some of the folks who've been active in the process are these three gentlemen, and right now they're going to speak a little bit about the process that has been underway, and then you're kind of reserving the right to speak to provide comments on different issues later, but right now you're here to talk about the consensus building process that's been underway. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Anthony Taylor, and I represent Compassionate Oregon, a patient advocacy group. And I was pleased to be invited into these work groups and be part of the conversation that I think has gotten us a good deal a ways down the road so that we can present the committee with some solid suggestions for a path forward. There was a lot of things discussed, and I think we reached consensus on a lot of those things, although in preparation for you for the committee, we're still, kind of making sure we've got them solidified so that we can utilize your help as well in sorting through some of the things that we didn't really weren't able to resolve. So, as a patient advocate, I am pleased with most of the things that we talked about. I think that many of the patients, while initially hesitant about their readiness or willingness to trust OLCC in all this process has changed a bit. I think the comfort level among many of the patients has risen, and I think that many of the issues that we talked about and came to a consensus on will play well, at least for many of the patients that I represent. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Jeff Sugarman from the Oregon Cannabis Pack. We are a group of processors, producers, dispensary owners, and other folks, all of whom are either small family farmers or small business owners who are looking to largely move or transition into the new recreational market as we move forward. Some of them, of course, may stay in the medical program, especially with the opt-in. I also want to add my thanks to the OLCC for convening this group. It has been really helpful for us to sit around the table and grapple with some of these issues. We support the Dash 8 version of 3400. We support the new productions limit language that's in there. We support the research section. We support the edibles section that can come in without delay. We support the medical opt-in. We think it's really important that we bring as many people and keep as many people in the system as we possibly can. I also want to thank a couple of other folks who have really been great participants who haven't been up here in front of you yet, Don Morris and Nikki Terziev with the Oregon Business Council, Lisa Nato, and Philo Biosciences, especially for the great work that she has brought on the research license and the testing provisions. I think we're moving ever closer, and we know that time is short. We've also shared a lot of this information with a larger group of lobbyists who meet every Monday and have gotten generally broad support for the consensus that we've reached on many of these issues, and it's been a great process, and we are stand ready to keep working it through to completion to sine die of this bill.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Sun Grown Growers Guild. It's a group of outdoor growers in Southern Oregon, primarily currently growing for the medical program, small family farmers. I had a chance to send you all an email on Friday kind of outlining our positions and where we are through the process so far, so I would just point you to that. Also say thanks for the process that is happening. I think OLCC stand with the gentleman to my left in saying thank you to Commissioner Patridge and to Steve Marks. They've done a good job in handling this committee. Everyone's getting to air out their concerns. There are some outstanding areas, certainly, of disagreement. I don't know if now's the time. If you'd like, I can highlight that. They're pretty much found in the email that I sent. But I share the same sentiments as the two gentlemen to my left that most of this we're agreeing on. So this is working good. We're going to talk again tomorrow. We want to keep that window open for additional talks. There are a few things that I think we're probably just going to, you know, have to agree to disagree on, and that's okay. We'll come to you with those issues. You know, we would prefer there to be more limitations on the inspection authority of family farms. So in this bill, the entire lot is still included as premises, and we think that you should designate an area of business activity as far as for the, because just recognizing that you're going to have inspectors coming onto someone's family farm. If they've got part of their farm that is the business activity, that would be where the jurisdiction of the inspector should be limited to, as compared to, hey, we're looking in your house. That's obviously a problem to bring. We're trying to bring people in. You have these little, you know, red flags like that. We would want to make sure that there's allowances for ecologically friendly packaging, so that nothing that the rulemaking would pursue would stop us from being able to package in an environmentally and ecologically friendly way. That is an ethos. It's part of who we are as the Guild. We support the strong environmental and water and electric kind of provisions to just advance a more sustainable path forward, and that's good for the state. We think really strongly that the residency requirement should be at least 2 years. It was already kind of a compromise made to bring it down from four, but we have Oregon farmers, Oregon family farmers that are doing this, that can produce, you know, the material correctly and you know, sufficiently, and we want to support those Oregon family farmers on an Oregon solution. We support, and this is one that came up just when I was down there Thursday night. So we heard a lot of feedback from really small growers. It's like, I'm a medical grower. I'm going to get licensed under OHA, but I'm still going to have some excess. And maybe I don't want to have all the jump through the hurdles of the OLCC, but maybe if it's a small enough excess that I could go down and maybe twice a year, you know, sell the excess into the OLCC system, like some allowance, but maybe it's just a couple of pounds a year, whatever that amount is. But for the small people who would just have some excess left over that they could go sell into the OLCC system without having to jump through the entirety of the hoops. So kind of like an allowance for small folks. Also, the notion of a medical co-op keeps coming up. Like, the people want that, because the story that I've heard on Thursday was, you've got the responsible medical grower wants to sell into the medical system, goes to a medical dispensary currently, notices that when the price that they get at the medical dispensary is way off base from what's being sold out the back end. So you come in, you sell it for X amount, and then you see your same product being sold for six times that amount by the dispensary. So just concerned from the farmer's perspective that if they're only pushed into this kind of medical system currently, like, they can really subject to the whims of how they get treated at the dispensary. So some semblance of a co-op form allows them to feel more comfortable with that business transaction. So we would hope that would be considered. And that's probably enough for now. I'll just hold off and again steer you to the document that I sent you and say thanks for the process.
Thank you so much. All right. Any questions for this panel? I think these folks will be invited back up if you signed up on the list, if you have additional comments that you want to make besides the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. At this point, we could walk through the bill. We can invite Mark Mayer to come back in. Senator Pulaski, would you like to be able to walk through the draft with Mr. Mayer in the room?
Well, I'm not sure how efficient that's going to be. I mean, for myself, I've not gone through it. I've let's say, highlighted the one that caused me some concern as to seeing a change that had not been discussed at this within this committee. And I think there's a couple other things that probably will come to light as we go through. So I don't know if we need to try to do that at this point.
All right. So, you know what, I think in that... Recognizing that, I'm going to proceed down the list of witnesses signed up, and if Mark comes back in, we can try walking through it page by page. But I think you're right that we need some time to digest the contents, and we'll probably have a fruitful conversation after we have done that. For now, I would love to invite John Sajo, Don Morse, Don Morse, and Jeff Sugarman up to the front. Thank you. And you'll be pleased to hear that we've asked for the HVAC system to be turned back on. So if anyone else is really warm.
Bring open some windows, man.
Yeah.
I'll get my tool. We'll open them up.
You want the windows open?
Yeah.
Good. All right. Mr. Morse, why don't you start, please?
Very well. Senator Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Donald Morse, and I'm here representing the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. I, too, have been honored to be a member of this small group that's been working on what you have before you. I'm here to say that industry, is ready to get behind this. We need something. This is the best that we've been able to come up with. It's required a lot of compromise from a lot of people, and I'm here to support it. That said, there is one item that was a matter of debate during all this, and that is taxation, and specifically the taxation of patients. It is our belief that patients, if they go into a retail establishment which has, both medically grown marijuana as well as retail grown marijuana, should be tax exempt. The compromise that we've reached is that in such a situation, if what they were looking for was not available on the medical side of the counter, so to speak, that they would be able to get it from the retail side, and that this, upon presentation of their card, would be tax-free. And I think it's very important. The patients have had to make a lot of compromises themselves in what we're trying to do here in order to give us a system of safe access that's going to work for everyone. And I think the least we can do is make sure that, for the most part, they are not going to be taxed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to note that I believe that OLCC had some additional comments that you still intended to make. And so after this panel, I'm going to invite you to finish up whatever presentation you felt like you were still intending to make before we proceed down the list. There are only about three people after this. So, gentlemen, thank you. I apologize for the disjunction there. But, Mr. Sajo, welcome and thank you. And if you guys are done, that's fine, too. But I just didn't want to cut you off early.
Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is John Sajo. I'm the executive director of the Umpqua Cannabis Association. And I want to thank you for your work on this bill. And I have a couple of comments. First, on the home grow part of it, I believe there's language floating around. I'm not sure if it's now in 3400 or if I saw it in one of the other bills, but that allowed a household that lived within 1,000 feet of a school to grow the four plants just like another household would. I urge you to make sure that is in there, because if it isn't, I think it'll be a big mess because people don't know whether they're 1,000 feet of a school or not and so forth. So I hope that part will be fixed. The second piece of that is people are going to be able to grow their four plants, but they're only allowed to possess 8 ounces. And I think, from the discussion of 964, where, you've now raised the limit for an indoor farmer of 6 plants to, a much larger amount, basically it's a problem. No one's going to be able to harvest their 4 plants without being a felon. So I hope you can somehow address that. And, that might be another thing incentivizing people to, sell their excess on the unregulated market if they're committing a felony by keeping more than that amount. Another point I'd like to bring up is the fee structure of all the license fees, and encourage you to consider making the license fees progressive. Last week we heard from Patrick Moen from Privateer Holdings, who described a $24 million 60,000 square foot garden that they have somewhere, I believe, in Canada. And I would just say that We know there's the possibility of giant entities like that in this industry, and I just think it's pretty clear that the cost of regulating a garden like that is going to be hundreds or even thousands of times the cost of regulating a small family farmer. And for that reason alone, I think having licensing fees that are tied perhaps to the gross revenue of the business makes a lot of sense. I also think you're here basically writing the laws and rules that are going to determine what this industry looks like in 10 or 15 years. And if we don't do something, we might have an industry that looks like a lot of other industries where there's three giant players that dominate it. And I don't think that's a good thing. I think instead we want to have thousands of small businesses. And I think a progressive license fee is a good way to address that, that would allow large entities to exist, but that would make them pay more of their share. I also think that that might represent a way out of this opt-out issue, because I think Mr. Bovet has pointed out that some local jurisdictions are concerned that they'll be inordinately affected by having a lot of licensees in their area, and maybe some of that increased revenue that would come from a progressive license fee could be directed to the local government, so they have an interest in having the licensees and have an interest in those licensees being successful. Now, I had a conversation earlier with one of the revenue people in the building, and he said, well, fees aren't for generating revenue. And I understand that, but I'd say in the medical marijuana program, they are. You all last year raised the fees on the sickest Oregonians to pay for other health care programs, and I think if we're going to do something like that, we could certainly raise the fees on the largest entities in this industry for the good of everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee, Jeff Sugarman again with the Oregon Cannabis PAC. Again, I want to reiterate how happy we are to have been a participant in these broad discussions to solve some of these troubling issues, and want to make it clear that I support and our PAC supports House Bill 3400. But there's one area in there that was raised earlier that I think I need to make some comments on. The energy section, the energy provisions in Section 116 have not been part of these discussions, and we have not been able to be part of a stakeholders group that's been working on these particular areas. Cannabis recreation growers are already facing more requirements than virtually any other industry, including licensure and product tracking and inspections and more. And we are fully supportive of those, and we stand ready to be a part of that new industry. We are also committed, and it's in our mission statement, to being good stewards of the land and the air and the water. Many of our members already have water conservation measures in place and energy and work very hard to reduce their energy footprint, and we will continue to be willing to work on energy conservation measures. But the tax that is envisioned, or the fee that's envisioned in Section 116, we see as hugely difficult to implement. It actually requires a fee even if the grower uses less energy than estimated. For example, the largest growers could be paying fees even if they use 40% less energy, at least my reading of the bill, than the Department of Energy's estimated usage. And I also want to point out it deals with energy in a way that we don't require of any other industry, not the new data centers, not other major electrical or energy users. And it sets a fee of 5 cents per kilowatt hour on that level. It's very hard to describe, I think, how this works, but on that level between the estimated usage and their actual usage if they go above the requirement that's set forth in the bill. And it has a very complicated tiered system based on size and different requirements. You know, as with the medical opt-in, our goal is to bring as many growers and people involved in the industry into this system as we possibly can. Adding fees, excessive fees, are not going to bring new people into the system. This is an issue where we need more time and more inclusiveness and more study and more participation from all of the industry participants to determine how best we should attack this issue of energy conservation and water usage and conservation. So though we support House Bill 3400, we do oppose the inclusion of Section 116 in the bill. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Sugarman, for those comments. Of course, the intent is not to unduly punish anyone. The intent is to try to, at the start of an industry, as industry is taking root, to try to set some standards on energy usage so we don't end up in a negative place. And I'm happy to sit down with you and talk with what's happening in Colorado and different ideas around that. I think we probably share the same goals on that score. Nobody wants to see the system be a drain or do damage, for instance, in Ashland. If usage goes up to a certain level, then the rates for all of the people that live in my town would go up. I know you don't want that. How do we address those things? So I look forward to those discussions. And I don't think you have any concerns, Mr. Sergio, about the gentleman who testified from Privateers, because he said at this time they're not interested in doing business in Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Sejo, you raised the concern about home growers harvesting their four plants potentially all at once, especially in the outdoor growing parts of our state, immediately exceeding their possession limits. Do you think that this idea of a co-op that has been circulating might solve that problem for home growers if the co-op was able to hold the harvest when it was ready to be held for a time that would allow that home grower to decide how they're going to be able to use it and be able to accommodate that use?
Co-chairs Leininger and Burdick, members of the committee, I guess I'm not quite sure how the concept of co-op would apply to the home growers. I don't understand it well enough to make an informed answer to the question. Well,
if I could have a follow-up.
Please, yes.
If there were a system by which you could store at a secure location as a home grower your harvest for a period of time to allow you to figure out how you're going to use it, maybe you wanted to turn it into concentrates or whatnot, would that satisfy your need without us having to change the possession amount?
It's certainly possible. I think you need to find some way just to address the problem, because it's pretty hard to grow plants that yield less than 2 ounces. So,
yeah.
I will also say that I've heard people already talking about, there's a certain way that this combination of bills would incentivize some people to get into the medical system and be a grower for someone, because then your limits are 70 times what they would be as if you're just growing your four plants. And other people have talked about, well, I'll do that and then I can store your marijuana for you because I won't have enough under my medical license. And so I think there's a lot of unintended consequences that might play out here if that weight issue isn't addressed somehow.
Thank you. Anybody have any comments on that? Yes, please.
Just quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Sejo, on the subject of progressive license fees, that does happen in various other trades. In my own radio broadcasting trade, the stations that don't push many watts don't pay much to the FCC for regulation fees, but the more power your stations have, you do pay higher regulation fees to them. So, yeah, certainly not unheard of in industry.
Yes, sir.
Since we have the individuals here and they're commenting on different stuff, I know Jeff and I think Don have been part of the work group, is that correct?
Correct.
And John, I don't know if you have been sitting in or if you're just monitoring from a side, but
I'm just watching the proceedings on television mostly, and we discuss them feverishly down in Douglas County, but we can't be up here quite often enough.
I appreciate that. So my question on the residency of 1 year, was that part of your discussions as to, can you tell us how that came about?
Chair Spurdick and Leininger, co-chair Przanski, I think there was broad support and almost unanimous consensus on the issue of the
financial investors.
Got that.
I think that we still have seen an array of folks in that group who have, you know, looked at either the 1 or the 2 year. I think generally, I think those were the two numbers that were discussed more frequently. There are some who also believe that there are other ways that we can advantage the Oregon businesses without any residency requirement. And so I think that's one of those issues where we just haven't gotten to the same place on, and it's one that I think is going to be out there for the next couple of weeks until the legislature and this committee decides which direction that they want to go.
Thank you.
Any follow-up questions? All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your input and your ideas. Next up, we have Todd Delotto, Jonathan Manton, and Lisa Nato. And then we have Pete Kramer, who signed up at the bottom. And you will be able to do cleanup batting for us.
Mr. Crawford up too?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, and we'll have Mr. Crawford up after this panel together with Mr. Kramer. Thank you for the reminder. Okay, great. We will have, Mr. Kramer, would you like to have Mr. Crawford go now, and you can be last in line because you signed up in the last spot? Okay. Mr. Crawford, please come up. Thanks.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name's Todd Delotto. I live outside Albany in Representative Olson's district. I'm a horticultural scientist, industry consultant, and public policy advisor, all specializing in cannabis. I've submitted very detailed written materials. I won't go into all those details here. But I wanted to point out a few things, starting with some of the definitions. I know what you're trying to get at with the definitions of concentrate and extract in trying to separate out, you know, the types of extractions and processing that may be hazardous and those that may be safer to do at home. And I've submitted a few suggestions earlier around those. But I just want to point out just a few things around the use of the word concentrates. Usually around concentrates means something you are extracting the water from to increase the concentration of the residual salts and such. This definition of concentrates is actually the opposite of that, infusing it in vegetable oil or such, you know. So I probably have a lot to say on some of the technical aspects, which I'm not going to bore you with. You're welcome to ask me questions later on. Additionally, the use of the term hydrocarbon. You may want to use the term alkane, which is the chemical family of propane and hexane and some of the things. Hydrocarbons is a much bigger, a broader word with a lot of other applications. And carbon dioxide is not a hydrocarbon, even though it's stated in there. Also, vegetable oils and animal fats are hydrocarbon-based, even though the hydrocarbons are attached to a triglyceride. Sorry, I'm not going to bore you. Around residency requirements, as an industry consultant, I have a lot of people with a lot of know-how and no capital, as well as a lot of people with a lot of capital and no know-how who want to get into this industry and here in Oregon. And I'm finding the people with know-how, with lack of capital, tend to be from Oregon, and those with capital and lack of know-how tend to be from out of state. But sometimes it's necessary to bring the two together to make businesses work. So something I would throw in there around residency requirements is if you're going to have any residency requirements around the investors or equity holders, I would recommend requiring 51% of the equity shares be among Oregon residents, and then the other 49% can be from wherever.
Okay.
And I think that would kind of address that. I think limiting canopy size is probably more relevant to yield than regulating on a per plant basis. I think our experience with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program and Dispensary Program have kind of proven that as well. I support the special licensing for nurseries, as well as research certification. I'm a horticultural scientist myself and would find that very appealing. I also think that we can also use some of this research certification and other research aspects around the energy use. Instead of having a rigid requirements around energy use, take some time to study it for a little while. And instead of having rigid requirements, have more incentives. If a producer can produce, very efficiently, perhaps they can be rewarded with tax incentives and such. For the first 5 years, it would be great to do research on how much energy it really does take to produce and process this, and offering incentives to processors and producers to participate in some state research over these next 5 years would be great as well. And I think offering financial and other types of incentives to retail and wholesale and such, so that maybe the state or some institutions can study those businesses and really learn this industry to make your jobs easier in the future, as well as users of adult use and medical as well.
Thank you. Great.
Sure.
Who would like to go next?
Co-chairs and Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Lisa Nato, representing Phylos Bioscience. And I want to express my appreciation to the hard work of this committee and the industry representatives and the OLCC who've been really rolling up our sleeves, learning from each other, and it's been a very productive process. Also very much appreciate the hard work of Mark Mayer over the weekend and pretty much all the time. With respect to some of the issues we've been really focusing on together, we appreciate the work you've done on the testing standards, again, and the lab certification. We think that looks really, really strong in this draft. On the issue of propagation, Mark did not mention, but I wanted to draw your attention to some differences in this draft, in the Dash 8 amendments, from the earlier draft amendments. There were concerns raised to me. As you know, we've been participating in some work groups around propagation issues, and I want to express my appreciation to Representative Leininger and also Representative Helm for attending those and offering insights. It came up that there were concerns both from the OLCC about having a parallel rulemaking process, the early implementation date, and also from some of the growers about having a separate license type or certification type. So in Friday's session I kept informing some of the nursery lobby about these changes. It was agreed to look at this draft having a certification type under a producer's license instead of a separate certification. So you will find it in an earlier section under the producer's license, but it would not be subject to the same weight and canopy limits as are under the other, might be under the other producers, because they would be, it would be immature plants and seeds. So we'll need some time to review this draft and make sure it incorporates what we've all been talking about, but that is what this draft represents. On the research certification, we thank you for including that. Thank you, Representative Buckley. And this looks like a very strong next step. We'll need to fine-tune the language as well. We had a very productive meeting on the issue of research with the OHA, some representatives, and we would still support including a what we would like to be called a task force on medical and public health research on cannabis, along the lines of Senator Edwards' proposal, which are now, and they're on OLIS, the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 480, which my understanding was the Oregon Health Authority was reviewing for possible changes. So we would still support incorporating that if it's possible to do so. With respect to this draft, this was something that was not really discussed in our work group, but the idea of temporary sales on October 1, that could be supported, but we would advocate that the testing and lab certification standards should be in place so that the cannabis released in that way would be would be protecting the public's health and safety. So that would mean increasing, making the labs license at an earlier implementation date, as well as we would ask then for the research date to be, right now it's set for December 1, and we've been trying to get that earlier because there is research that needs to be done on what the testing standards should be, in our opinion, around pesticides and perhaps heavy metals. So we would argue that, or suggest that the committee consider moving up those other lab testing dates and the research dates if that were to be the case.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Excuse me. Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Seth Crawford. I teach at Oregon State University in the School of Public Policy. I just wanted to bring up a couple issues on the canopy sizes. I know I came here last week and mentioned that this was probably the most important issue that you'll be dealing with. And I just wanted to reiterate that. And I had a few concerns with that. What are those canopy sizes going to look like? I'd really like to know. When we're looking at the recreational market, we're talking about between 30,000 pounds and 60,000 pounds on a lower bound and an upper bound. That could be met in Southern Oregon with 5,000 square foot greenhouses. I don't know if we only want 7 producers. I don't think people in Oregon who are producing right now want 7 producers. on the other side of this, we could look at things like 1,000 square feet, lower yields, a little bit different technology. You'd be looking at about 147 sites. So we're looking at a maximum of 147 sites for the recreational program if we're going to meet the existing demand. And that's if the existing demand is 60,000 pounds, which I honestly don't think it is. I think it's a little bit lower than that. It's an area of concern for me, and I think it should be an area of concern for a lot of growers in the state who want to make the move into the recreational market. Another issue that I have with this at this point is what is it that we think about when we think about Oregon marijuana, Oregon cannabis? What sort of brand does Oregon cannabis have at this point? I think of the words pure, natural, organic. Some would say sun-grown. That's up to the trade alliances to discuss. But nowhere in that is half of our production devoted to indoor grows. We have an incredible ecology, second to none in the world, really, when it comes to marijuana production. And I think that it's problematic to devote half of our production to indoor production. And along with that, there's some issues with that definition. I think we need to be very careful with how we define indoor and outdoor. Again, there was no delineation on what indoor meant. When we look at, I mentioned this last time as well, if we're looking at greenhouses with no foundations, those are considered outdoor grows. And you can have supplemental lighting in there. I think we need to be very careful with the language of that. I don't necessarily have an issue with just leaving it up to rulemaking, but I think we need to be very, very clear about what those numbers are before those rules get adopted. And again, there's nothing really wrong with canopy sizes versus plant counts. I don't think that's an issue. But, I mean, it's when we're looking at Oregon, I think we need to take into consideration that we are very unique compared to a lot of other locations. I made a joke earlier today saying that, you know, this is sort of like the looking towards Washington and Colorado for developing canopy sizes and plant counts is akin to the city of Phoenix asking the city of Calgary for advice on constructing outdoor hockey rinks. We have a very different environment from anyone else, and I think we need to really take that into consideration. And I'd also like to echo some of the concerns that John Seja just mentioned about capturing the market over time. Excuse me. One of the issues I think we're going to see with this is, especially if we go with very large canopy sizes, really at the early stages of this sort of nascent formalized marketplace, is that we're going to see those who have the most capital able to weather the immediate storm. They're going to, if we have 5,000 square foot canopies, we're going to have a huge surplus of marijuana produced. It's going to push the prices down dramatically, and only those people who are well capitalized will be able to stay in the market for 2, 3, 4 years until everyone else has been pushed out. And I think that's a really important consideration as we move forward.
Thank you very much for that cheerful bit of information. No, thank you. That's helpful. Does anyone have questions? This was a really thought-provoking panel.
Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I think I'm a little slow tonight. So I want you to go over again the canopy size versus the demand and what your recommendation is for us, because I think that really is crucial as we move forward on this. You said something about having 7 producers versus 147? I wondered if you just elaborate on that.
Co-chairs Leininger, co-chair Burdick. I'd be happy to put a spreadsheet together based on some of the estimates that I've done over the last 3 years on production, canopy counts, plant counts, and Oregon agricultural practices as it relates to cannabis, and be more than happy to share it with you. The short message is, we consume, the recreational market is likely to consume anywhere between 30,000 and 60,000 pounds. And
that's per year?
Per year, yeah, that's right. And we can produce that in a very small number of sites if necessary.
Senator President.
Oh, wait, before
please.
We move past that point, this draft has some parameters in it. And so am I hearing you correctly that you think the draft as it is would attract a few large grows and maybe limit the number of people who could participate?
Co-chairs Leininger, co-chair Burdick, that's correct. The way that I read the draft that was submitted today, there are no limits. It will be adopted by rule. And I also heard mention of production quotas, which is a fantastic idea. I think that's a really good way to be able to, you could have unlimited canopy sizes if you want, so long as production quotas are included. However, I could not find a reference to that in the legislation.
I feel like Representative Buckley would really like to do a follow-up.
I'd just like to, how would a production quota work? How would that work? I mean, you'd be saying to a grower, you have permission to have this size canopy, but your quota is, I'm not sure what the concept is.
Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, Representative Buckley, I believe that's how it would work. Say you have 500 pounds as your quota, and you figure out the most economically way to meet the state's requirements.
Gotcha.
And meet consumer demand for that 500 pounds.
Interesting.
There's a problem with that.
Pardon me?
I said there's a problem with that.
Would you like to elaborate?
Yeah. Farmers who raise stuff for canneries, they have a quota that they have to meet. And if they meet it, fine. If they have excess, they can do whatever the heck they want with it.
Correct.
That's the problem.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. So I see that Senator Prezansky has been waiting to ask a question. Did you have a follow-up, Representative?
No, okay. I'm trying to let others.
Yeah. So, Seth, then the part that you've said as to what you forecast is the need for the recreational consumption in the state, remind me as to what you think, what you believe the medical consumption rate is.
Co-Chairs Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick. Senator Prezansky, about 3 to 5 times what we consume.
How much do you think is actually needed for medical? I'm trying to do a balance of medical versus recreational, because the numbers you've given us seems pretty low from what I would assume would be the demand on the recreational side.
So the way that we need to look at consumption in the state, it's the 80-20 rule, and this applies for a number of different substances, including alcohol and tobacco. 20% of the user base consumes approximately 80% of the total supply. And in the state of Oregon, about 12% of the marijuana users are currently enrolled in the medical marijuana program. Of those, a significant percentage, my research would suggest between 90 and 95% fall into the category of a super user, would be the 20% who consumes the 80%, which leaves approximately 8% of the super users to consume in the recreational market. The recreational market demand is very low because the rest of the consumers, that other 20%, consume on average about 1.2 grams per month, as opposed to anywhere between 60 and 80 grams per month with the super users.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. So what would the yearly consumption of the current medical marijuana market be? Is that what you were trying to get at?
Yeah.
I would like to hear that number as compared to 30 to 60.
I would have to grab my computer, co-chair. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. But I can provide that information pretty quickly.
But it's considerably lower than 30 to 60,000 pounds.
No. In fact, it would be more. It would be closer to 80 to 90,000 pounds is off the top of my head. I've done the estimate before, but it's in a spreadsheet on my computer. And it's just a follow-up to Senator Cruz, if I may. One of the problems that we've heard from medical patients here is that the movement of medical growers into this recreational market is likely to provide or produce a shortfall, especially for the most needy and the most economically disenfranchised. If we had a production quota system where farmers knew that they were going to be able to make enough money to stay profitable, I think it would be a fantastic idea to maybe divert some of that to needy medical patients.
All right. Thank you very much for that. I don't see more questions for you at this time, but I do believe that OLCC may have some thoughts on the early start concept and any other closing thoughts before we go to Pete Kramer, who will be our finale for the evening. Did you have, you had additional thoughts, right? Thank you guys for being flexible.
Again, for the record, co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. There were several items that we didn't include as part of our discussion, as part of that ad hoc group that we put together, because we felt like we were over our ski tips and well outside the purview of what the OLCC should be discussing. But we did think, and the group thought, that those were issues that this committee should take on or have a hearing about, or some of those issues may be resolved. The first of which was land use. Specifically, the land use compatibility piece that's in this, as well as the time, place, and manner restrictions. Those were some substantial issues that we felt like we were well outside the purview to comment on, but we felt like that would be something that this committee should spend some time on, and that was the interest of the grower group. In addition to that, the tax issues, again, there was the recommendation that it be a blended rate and bonding authority and a variety of other things. We're continuing to talk to Co-Chair Burdick related to some of the tax issues because she's been the lead as the former revenue chair on the tax stuff. And so we'll continue to do that. But the tax issues and rate and those kinds of things obviously are going to need some work. In addition to that, we did talk a little bit about the residency requirement. There was consensus around that there be no requirement on the capital side for residency, but the background checks on those was agreed upon by the industry as a consensus piece. The residency requirement as to the applicants or owners was no consensus there. There was, you saw varying groups, so that was for you all. In addition to that, minors was an issue related to minors and should they be allowed in medical or should they be allowed in licensed establishments. There were some questions that were raised related to DHS or other items related to how we're going to treat those people, especially as you look at family farms and other things that would be properly licensed. But how do you deal with those from a child welfare issue, and how the legislature wants to deal with those things could be somewhat complex or maybe an easy fix. So that would be something that this group should deal with. So those are the four items that we really tried to emphasize related to the discussion that we felt like was necessary that wouldn't come from our group. As to the early start pieces, you had two early start pieces. One was within Section 129 of the -8 amendments that you all have. OLCC is not involved in that particular piece as they're currently contemplated in Section 129-8. And then there's the -3 amendments that we saw today that have OLCC playing a variety of roles related to that. OLCC would just like to stress to this committee that we really want to get it right, and Oregon really wants to get it right. You've seen the struggles that Washington and Colorado had in implementing. They had about the same types of implementing timelines, about a year and a half, once the final statute or constitutional measures were adopted in those states before they had to implement the recreational marijuana. We're doing nothing different from that. We Washington, in fact, Colorado even had seed to sale tracking in for medical beforehand to give them that jump start. So we want you to have that under consideration as you're thinking through kind of the jump start, quick start kinds of things. You already heard from Lisa and Ida today related to testing, molds, pesticides, all those things. All those rule things take time, and they take time for us to do, and we certainly want to do it right. In Oregon, we learned the lack of really clear expectations and well-thought-out rules were clearly impediments for an orderly start with an adequate supply to recreational users in both Washington and Colorado, and we need to take those mistakes and learn from those mistakes so that we can get it right and we have credibility in the system. We believe that rushing to implement is fraught with requirements that will disrupt our agency from really implementing Measure 91, because it will be a major changing of the rules kind of midstream to try and hit a really early start date. We have a lack of staffing or staffing authorization as it currently is. Currently, we don't, you know, it's unclear on the legislative funding piece. There's no public or local government input on the rulemaking if we were to jumpstart that, which is included in the Measure 91 recreational opt-out pieces. The impact of recreational sales on the availability of medical marijuana for medical patients is an issue to be considered. Whether this marijuana is now all going to be sold out through the dispensaries in the current stream of commerce or not, and how that's going to impact medical patients, we don't know what that is going to be. There's also the setting of public expectation for less regulation than when I think the covenant with many voters was we were going to have a system similar to what the OLCC does related to alcohol. And then creating a loosely regulated system, we believe, opens up not only a recreational system but the medical system to federal scrutiny that may or may not come one way or the other. So we would suggest as the OLCC that you adhere to the timelines outlined in Measure 91 and allow its implementation to continue to move forward in an orderly, well-thought-out manner. It may take some patience, but we believe at the OLCC that the public will overall benefit from a well-thought-out, timely, regulated system.
Senator Prezonsky.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess looking at Section 129, which, Rob, was what you're just going over, I guess, doing comparison, I'll tell you, from my perspective and working with Senator Farioli, this is an approach I think is an appropriate one, and I think we can make a valid argument, as he has, as to the Cohn memo of trying not to divert or allow for a more entrenched underground market to flourish and actually materialize at some great period. And I noticed that one of the things that Senator Farioli and I talked about this morning, I was suggesting that maybe we need to get that up running, because I know he would like to have it up by July 1. But one of the things that's been holding us back is the ability to collect the tax, because we more than likely wouldn't have that system in place. But clearly, based on the way this is written, it would allow for that tax to start being garnered and attached once the Department of Revenue has it, the capacity to do that, and that would allow for the immediate onset of those sales with a limited amount. And I also agree with that, like limiting it to 1/4 ounce purchase, and then also allowing for, it looks like, for plants to be able to be sold, but not to go into the sale of edibles, extracts, for multiple reasons. And I think that's the issues that we need to look at, is what type of potential of potencies, and how much do we actually want the general public to be rolled out to without having the education and understanding of what they're getting into before they get into it.
I'm hoping that Senator Farioli, you have some thoughts on this.
I do, Madam Great. Chair. Thank you for asking. I certainly appreciate the complexity of the challenge of bringing the whole program to fruition on the timelines that are specified in Measure 91. And I wouldn't argue against that. I think those well-thought-out objectives and properly vetted and developed rules are necessary. But the idea of having legal consumption on July 1st with no legal outlet other than home grow is incongruous and illogical. So I would simply suggest that we take a look at all the alternatives, including a conversation with Oregon Health Authority to see if they have the ability, under a memorandum of agreement with the Oregon Liquor Control folks, OLCC, to see if there isn't an authority that could be granted to those medical facilities to start offering a very limited selection of products July 1. The tax issue is a different issue. The tax issue has as much to do with the inaccessibility of the banking system as it has with anything, although, Madam Chair, through some anomaly in the law, the Department of Revenue can take direct cash payments from a marijuana producer without a violation of the Cole Memorandum under a theory of states' rights. I love these paradoxes because it's proof that death and taxes are the only inevitability in life. but I think what we would benefit from is a sort of a collaborative conversation between the folks from Revenue, OHA, and OLCC to see if there isn't a very limited opportunity for an on-time start. It isn't early. It's July 1, and we've been talking about this since February, so it's no surprise to anybody. But I believe, because of the conversations I've had with people in OHA and Department of Revenue and other places, that there's no obstacle that we cannot surmount. But the idea of a soft start on July 1 shouldn't at all interfere with OLCC's rollout of the 2016 well-thought-out, well-engineered full program that the directors just referred to. And Madam Chair, if I could be indulged for just one second.
Yes,
more.
Please.
I've had some success with my appeal to the governor's office for convening a banking work group.
Great.
And the governor's office has, in fact, convened that group. And credit unions, banks, representatives of MBank, the representatives of the treasurer's office, in addition to other folks that have a direct interest, attorney general's office and others, convened and started discussing the fact that four states have recreational marijuana laws on the books. A total of 33 states have some connection to medical marijuana. The Western States Governors Association, the National Association of Attorneys General, a.k.a. NAG, I love the acronym, Council of States Governments West. There's literally a slew of organizations out there that all have the same problem that they have to solve, and that's the lack of a safe harbor for entry into the federal banking system. So, you know, the conversation has started at that level. It may have to go to the regional or national banking associates, but there's every reason to believe that with 33 states wrestling with the issue of access to federal banking, that there should be a strong effort for reclassification and a stronger effort for some sort of a memorandum of understanding for those states that have a highly regulated system to access the federal banking system, so that we don't have to have armored cars and security folks and wads of cash with rubber bands and shoe boxes and all of the stuff that currently typifies the recreational illicit market. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else closing comments with this panel? Thank you. And Mr. Kramer, we would love to hear from you if you are still interested in offering some thoughts.
Hello, thank you.
My name's Pete Kramer. I'm with Mercy TV, Mercy Center. I've been filming these hearings so the public can see what's happening, the decisions, and the language that has been talking. You're doing a fine job. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody? But a single outdoor plant may produce 10 pounds or more. A single indoor plant may only produce an ounce or two, maybe five, if you're lucky, if you have the height to grow it in. I grow medically. I'm a patient. I help several other patients out in with that. I have enough to last us till the next harvest and a little bit longer. So if that's any count, thank you for your listening to the patients and the other people here.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.
Thank you.
All right.
Good day.
So we have, I'm going to let you know what I expect is going to happen tomorrow. More stakeholders are going to be having conversations, looking carefully at this draft, the 3400-8. We are hoping that by the end of the business day tomorrow, we will have some additional refinements to Mark Mayer so he can incorporate them into a draft bill that will be ready for us to have a public hearing on probably Wednesday, and I'm going to turn it over to my co-chair, Senator Burdick, for her word on the Wednesday meeting.
Okay, well, we will be plowing through this amendment, the new amendment on Wednesday that will reflect the work product tomorrow. It's a very ambitious agenda tomorrow to basically get the whole thing solved. And so we'll want to make sure that we get a diversity of opinion from everyone who has a stake in this at our hearing on Wednesday. It'll be an important hearing.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So I'm going to close the public information session and adjourn. Thank you. Thank you. And adjourn.